Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The VN Team.
QNL.
With guest co-hosts.
Steve G. 700.
Can I actually start the show?
So should I just start talking? Or silly?
Oh, no, not... Never talk, Steve, no. Don't you know that guests are meant to be seen, not heard? Wait.
Wait, let's do it.
Greetings and salutations. We've got Q&L.
Blah, blah.
Makalua.
It's too early for blah, blah. What are you talking about?
The main team.
Girl, look at my KD.
Dan Q.
I am your sunshine.
And Steve G, known as Steve G700 on certain forums.
That's you.
The official Civilization 5 Gods and Kings website is now up and running at civilization5.com/gods and kings. My first reaction to finding out this was, finally? You know, we've only known about the expansion for so many months.
Yeah, there was a lot of dribs and drabs of information. Kind of amazing to see, like, a two-year-old game like this and everybody going crazy just tearing through every little video preview and, you know, screenshotting every frame so they could zoom in. And it's like some sort of, you know, something out of 24, something where people are just like zooming in and enhancing and enhancing and enhancing this one frame at a time just to try to spot some clue.
Yeah, I think there were certain leader videos on the new Gods and Kings website that people were liking to zoom in on. Not mentioning any names or any reasons why, but... The thread on CNN.
I think I can guess why.
I think you can guess. Like, three quarters of the comments are actually about the voice actors or actresses, particularly the voice actresses used for the leader speaking. Oh, this person sounds too young. This person sounds too old. Da 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 da. And I'm just thinking, oh my gosh. But there was one comment by Leaks. L-I-E-X, likes maybe, I don't know. We focused actually on 2 points. One was a slip, which is where the official site talks about 4 new scenarios that Gods and Kings are going to introduce. Either that is a slip, or we just haven't found out about the 4th scenario, and I think there's an entire separate thread on CFC, which is, guess what the 4th scenario is? So, maybe it's not actually a slip. That would be awesome if it was not. But my favorite part was where the website describes Sid Meier's Civilization 5 Gods and Kings is the first expansion pack for Civ 5. So, of course, this person is like, the first gives me hope. And I'm thinking, okay, you can actually take that in one of two ways. You're either hoping that the first expansion is so good that there's enough impetus to actually have a second one, or you're hopeful that there will be a second one to correct the mistakes of the first. I don't know.
You could just be hopeful that there's going to be another expansion, Dan, good or bad. Boring. No?
That's a boring interpretation, Mackie.
No.
That. Come on.
Oh, no. Reasonable and logical. We can't have that around here.
And then I was actually looking for a discussion of what are each of these leaders saying. And it is true that some people were debating the languages being spoken and whether or not it was appropriate that they were speaking these languages, or the tie-in between the voice actors and actresses in the languages, whether or not the voice actors and actresses were actually pronouncing the words properly. I was really looking for a translation. When you go to the official website for Gods and Kings, you click on Civilizations, and then you choose one. And I was like, oh, that's kind of neat. And you can pre-order Gods and Kings now for a 10% discount, so that'll save you something like, what, $3?
Ooh.
Matt Mackey's thrilled. She's going to leave the podcast just for a few moments just to order it, pre-order it right now based on what I just said.
Yeah.
Just including this topic here, looking in our Ustream chat, want to give a shout-out to Bam Bam and Imperator for joining us live, as opposed to joining us dead. I don't mean that. The guests, we have 3 guests, but Bam Bam and Imperator are registered users on Ustream, so they can interact with us during these live recordings. Imperator says, regards to the pre-order discount, well, it's $3 better than nothing. And I guess a lot of my comment from that was when it comes to discounts, Steam generally has some very aggressive sales from time to time. Just one that passed in between the recording of the last episode was 75% off Civilization V on Steam, and you could play the game for free for about a day and a half. There's a bit of a tease on the official website. If you go to, leave us the downloads menu, you see some wallpaper and something else, and then there's podcasts coming soon. Maybe it's just a web design preference of mine, but why not you just not have podcasts there at all until you actually do have that content? I just have these flashbacks of the 1990s and, you know, personal websites, otherwise known as blogs. Anyway,
cool. Those things are still around?
Yeah, I'm surprised blogs are still around too, Phil. Ridiculous. No.
So.
Where you go to a website and you say, oh, click here. And I mean, at least the whole page isn't like this, but if you click on it, it'd be like, coming soon. It's like,
under construction.
Under construction.
Hard hat and all the bulldozers and stuff.
I was like, oh. Yeah, oh, yes, the animated graphics as well. Sometimes the actual sequence. Oh.
Yeah, that kept me entertained for like a second and a half more before I clicked away.
On the next episode of NostalgiaCast, we'll talk about embedded MIDI files on websites. which I was, I'll say guilty of. I was actually guilty of that.
I was just clicking around on here, and their list of new wonders doesn't list everything, but did nobody mention they had the Hubble Space Telescope as one? Did I miss that on a previous podcast? Did we not mention this? I'm sorry, I'm a space nerd. I'm happy. I don't know. It doesn't tell me. There's just a nice picture of
it. SpaceX.
I mean, I've heard of it. I don't think we got any info on what it does. Doubtful that it has anything to do with religion.
Yeah, but there's a religious screen on the same page, and one of the reasons is Zoroastrianism.
Ah, yeah, Zoroasticism. Excellent. Now, the icon that we've seen for Zoroasticism is the best religious icon. Therefore, you should check that religion every single time. And if you can't get Zoroasticism because the AI takes it, you must rage quit and try again.
No, you conquer them and take their religion.
The MM says, 2K and Valve already have my money for Gods and Kings. Now we play the waiting game. We play the waiting game so much in gaming as well as this something called real life. It's wonderful. What are the victory conditions for the waiting game anyway?
Time. Obviously. Started by Plum Smuggler. This thread is titled Machine and Gatling Gunners. And it reads, I noticed that machine and Gatling gun units have the same melee as range damage and only have a range of 1. Is the idea behind these units that they are a frontline defender and that the single hex is meant to punish anyone who dares to attack them head on? It seems like the unit's sole purpose is to scare away melee units like infantry and tanks. It would also be perfect for locking down cities, much like how they were used in Civ 4, well, sort of. And he also is curious if they have a bonus versus infantry and a penalty against tanks, which admittedly would make sense. I've not heard of too many machine guns working particularly well against tanks, so that might be the case. But as others have pointed out in the thread, this is probably just an upgrade for the archery units, and they probably will tear people alive when you're approaching them. People are speculating that there's going to be like a siege setup mechanic, so you can't just move that attack. It's going to be like a siege piece, which is interesting. And I wouldn't have a problem with that if the trade-off was that they're really powerful units. But, you know, if the archery promotions carry over, then that one range might become 2 range, and you know, that might be multiple attacks. So you do have to be careful from that regard. But it is nice that archers upgrade past crossbows now. Bring up M60 big ammo!
2 points for me on this. Yes, this is a continuation of the archery line. We learned earlier that between the archer and the crossbowman, they've introduced the composite bowman. So now you go archer, composite bowman, crossbowman now, instead of upgrading to a rifleman, will upgrade to a Gatling gun. And then the Gatling gun, which we don't know the technology that it comes at this point, will then upgrade to a machine gun when you get to ballistics. And the point about them having to set up like a siege unit, that comment was from GamerKG, and a couple of other people pointed out, where did you get that information from?
He never
said. Because, yeah, like them, I have not seen that anywhere. And then he later admitted that, I thought I remembered seeing it somewhere, but I couldn't find it, and I think I might have just gotten it confused with something else. So if they had to set up like a siege unit, I'd kind of be like, even more limited usefulness. But I think perhaps an advantage to the machine and the Gatling gunner is not so much about the comment about how they were used in Civ 4, because yeah, that's open to question, but perfect for locking down cities, which to me in that interpretation means you sit them inside a city for defense while the rest of your forces continue to move on. Which, by the way, if you choose certain social policies, that could actually that increase your happiness. I'm trying to think of it when you're going. I think it's down the honor line. One of the policies that you get gets you happiness for every unit that you. If you have a unit stationed in the city, you get plus one happiness.
Yeah, that's a great policy. I love it.
So now here's a unit that is not only, I don't know if you want to say perfect for that, but more ideal for that, if for no other reason than not because that they're necessarily ideal for that, but rather than having to use one of your other units to continue on that perhaps, you know, that doesn't have that limited range or has greater strength or actually has some promotions against certain other types of units that you want to kind of continue going to the field, you don't want to hold them back, these units can do that instead, the Gatling and the machine guns.
Yeah, it's only got the one range, but artillery at that point has a 3-tile range anyways, so city can't attack them anyways. So about the only thing where the one range screws you is, you know, mounted units coming in and then moving away after they hit you.
And it's interesting you mentioned about the artillery 3 range because I forget who it was in the thread, but someone pointed out that 3 range had better been reduced. Otherwise, this unit is pointless. But, again, I think a lot of people are making that thought process in the context of what combat is like right now in Civ 5. But as we have been told, combat in Civ 5 was too slow, and therefore combat is going to take a little longer. The one-shotting units is not going to be as commonplace, that where once before a one-shot might have done it is going to take 2, if not even 3 times. So in terms of how this works in context, even if they don't touch artillery with the 3 range strength, that still may not be necessarily a negative thing against the Gatling and machine guns.
And if they hurt a lot, that would help them out too. And a lot of it just comes down to their relative strength to what they're fighting. And that will make a big difference. Because, if they hurt more than artillery but have shorter range, well, you know, a lot of them could be a problem, and a range of them could be like a friggin' pillbox trying to get into that. And, do they have the same defensive penalties as archers? If not, then they can actually be a very big issue even at the front, depending on what the AI or human chooses to do. So there's a couple ways you can go with this. Well, I'll just have to see, I guess.
Basically, you have to see how much damage they can do in that one shot they get in before someone meshes into them.
Yes, and then is it easy to mesh into them, or are they actually competent defenders? Because they're saying they have the same range strength as melee strength, which is not true for archery units in Civ 5. That might be the case. So they might be intended as the kind of unit that just kind of screws with the zone of control. It's really difficult to deal with, and you have to attack it, or else it attacks you as you try to get around it. It might be something like that. You just get a couple forts on borders with those suckers and just ruin the AI's day. That would be fun.
Gatling gun seems more of like an industrial area type tech, just off the top of my head, just going by history.
Yeah, but then that's so close to the machine gun. I think they'd have to pull it, for balance purposes, pull it back a little bit and put it somewhere like mid to early Renaissance. Probably mid Renaissance, to be fair. Because otherwise, you're just going to be like, Gatling gun, then machine gun, which, that's actually what happened in real life. But
like we do with musket men and riflemen now. You go to get the riflemen so quick that, musket men never really have their day in the sun.
Bandam says in the chat that, quote, the folks that have complained in the past about city defense and how difficult it is to take them probably won't be welcoming the Gatling machine gun units, unquote.
Probably not.
Machine guns used in Civ 4 are nothing like they're going to be used in Civ 5, and that is a good thing. Machine guns were really only useful when you had a tech lead in Civ 4, and were taking on large numbers of dated units trying to attack you, because they had a collateral damage of immunity, one of the very few units in the game that had immunity to collateral damage from the ground anyway. And they had a bonus against gunpowder-based units. So, if you're being attacked by rifles, grenadiers, infantry to a lesser extent, because infantry will still hurt you quite a bit, then you could really chew through a lot of that stuff. And then their base strength was so high with drill promotions that they would just slaughter things like maces and knights and whatever as well. But they couldn't attack at all. And yeah, that's not the feeling you're getting from these units in Civ 5. These units are probably going to be reasonably devastating if you're too close to them in Civ 5. Whereas in Civ 4, as long as you didn't attack them, they couldn't do anything to you at all. So it's a different kind of unit, and it serves a different purpose in the game. I mean, aside from the obvious stat changes, they're not going to be anything like Civ 4.
So as far as trying to read the designers' minds here, why do you guys think they might have made them just a one-range unit instead of why narrow that range down from two?
It's either for balance or flavor. That's my guess. Flavor, because there isn't another unit like that in the vanilla version of the game. Your ranged units tend to have, for the most part, two range or more. And on the other side of things, they also defend better than your traditional archery type of units as well. And while giving an upgrade path, it kind of creates a unique era flavor when I'm just thinking about it from that standpoint. And that is something that sometimes felt like it was missing, and it's nice to see a little of that back.
Right, and in respect to them being siege units, it sounds like they're very much the opposite of siege units. They're there, they got to run up and sort of stick their guns down people's faces or sit there and wait for people to walk up to them. I mean, that's not what you do with siege engines.
Well, yeah, a ranged unit that defends as well as it attacks because it has the same melee as ranged, then actually puts you in danger of just flat out spamming them like crazy and attacking people who can't really retaliate too effectively. So my guess is they'll be made a little bit weaker than contemporary infantry to compensate for that.
Yeah, I expect it is a combination of balance and flavor like Phil was getting at. And to that balance thing, we don't want a situation where you get to this particular era, and even if other civilizations are, especially if they're matched with you in technology in the sense that, well, I'm just going to build this one type of unit, and I have a better chance than not to actually steamroll. It's the combined arms discussions that we've had before. Bam says, I'll be happy to get some extended use out of my ranged unit promotions. It's tough to see my currently pumped up archers and composite bowmen waste that valuable experience. And that will actually be interesting to see what happens on upgrade for those units that you have upgrade. And I think this was touched on near the beginning of the conversation about whether or not that will translate into, like if you start with an archer and a composite bowman and then you move up to crossbowman and then upgrade to a Gatling gun, then are you going to lose that ability to, you know, in terms of the range, only have it go down to one? I expect the answer to that will be yes, that that is something that you would lose, because if it's not, then I can already see people writing a thread about it, if it's not already, even before the game exists. This is what you do to get super-duper machine gun and Gatling guns.
Well, it's definitely interesting to just see how it's going to work, to see take a machine gun unit and just sort of march it along against technologically weaker units and just sort of trying to mow them down with first strikes, essentially, before they even get to hit you. Will you be able to do that 100 hit points on pikemen or something like that?
Your range to a double attacking machine gun out there and just start spraying people down with a couple of this.
But they're ranged units, so they can't capture cities?
Well, yeah, that's another interesting question, because archery units can't do that. But then if we're saying, okay, you're going from an archery unit, like a machine gun and a Gatling gun would probably be categorized as a gunpowder unit, would they actually be able to move in and to take cities? Or would they not be able to do that? That question has not been answered.
And if they're part of the archery chain, I would tend to think that they would suffer the same limitation and not be able to do the capturing. Since that chain has always stopped at a crossbowman up until now, we'll have to see.
I wonder if they'll just switch it from being considered archery, quote-unquote, to, like, non-siege ranged or something. Because it was always amusing in Civ 4, you had a class of units called helicopter units. It's like, really? There's one unit in that class. I could see the other route they could go then is to make, like, the Gatling gunners and machine gunners their own little class, I guess. And maybe they'll be able to take cities then. Because it would be kind of silly for them not to be able to take cities.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of see where the archers couldn't take a city, but come on, a bunch of guys with machine guns or Gatling guns, I'd be surrendering too.
Yeah.
Well, we talked about being aggressive with Gatling gun and then machine guns. What about not, Mackie?
Well, yeah, that's another topic over on Civ Fanatics. So, talking about Bade White, what is his username? B. Kaiko?
Yes, we had him on a few episodes ago, actually.
Ah, okay. I thought that was right. I was wondering recently why Civ 5 doesn't have some kind of a non-aggression treaty that the Civs could sign to prevent constant wars of backstabbing. We don't know too much about the potential treaty options in the expansion, so he thought he'd bring up the idea. Could be enforced like a peace treaty, so you'd get penalty if you tried to do it. Various benefits. Other people in the thread have pointed out that the Declaration of Friendship is kind of like that-ish. And then somebody pointed out in real life, these don't really work out so well.
Yeah,
ask the Germans and the Soviets.
So what they're basically talking about is a pact where you, like, literally you can't attack during the duration of that pact, right? So,
yeah.
Like, it's, you know, so that's the not like real life, because in real life it's just a piece of paper, which is why to me it seems like a pretty terrible idea to have that in the game. The reason to have something like that in the game is so you could sign it and then just suddenly start acting like a jerk towards that civ, because they can't do squat about it. You know, they have to sit and wait for the pact to expire, sit around sharpen their knives, waiting for the next 25 turns while you do whatever you would do that you wouldn't normally do, because it would agitate them. I mean, if you're being a good neighbor, you don't need a non-aggression pact. If you're being a jerk, that's when you need a non-aggression.
One exception is when you each want to go kill somebody else. I could see the benefit of enforcing a signing of this danger. And when you're not talking about, like, blazing quick turns played in multiplayer, then non-aggression pacts, as they are very common in multiplayer Civ games. I mean, if you're playing with people that you're familiar with, you know that you have a secure border, and they know they have a secure border for a while, and that basically means you can focus your attention elsewhere.
I think of it as like this. I mean, non-aggression pacts exist in the game as, you know, you behaving a certain way towards your neighbor, not drawing their ire, you know. I like backstabbing being in the game. I like the uncertainty of that kind of politics in the game. So, I personally would hate such a thing to be in the game.
That's interesting, because I would like to see such a thing in the game. I think it's well raised in this thread and defended by B. Kaiko. With regards to the realism versus... Well, just realism in general with regards to the non-aggression pacts. In Civilization V right now, and this is the case in Civilization IV too, you sign a peace treaty, you have X number of turns where that is enforced. You can't actually attack until that time has passed. So he's looking at an equivalent of that before you actually get to that point. As he describes it, a declaration of friendship with teeth. And he also talks about, and I know that this may be a bit of a practical problem, especially when it comes to the AI, but I don't think that that should preclude this consideration entirely, which is if you decide to get into a non-aggression pact, you're weighing pros and cons here. You have to decide whether or not that this is a good idea to enter into, because I know that I am forced not to attack that person, but in turn, they also can't do the same. So the AI should be thinking about your behavior so far in the game and whether or not they want to go so far to restrict themselves to that, similar to the difference between a peace treaty and a ceasefire, where, yes, it's an end to hostilities, but a ceasefire, I'm thinking more of Civilization IV here, but in any event, that the ceasefire just stops the fighting, but there is no X number of turns that you are forced not to do that. So you still have the option. It's just for those people, if I can actually get that option, either I'm a peaceful person entirely in the game, I'm a builder, or I want to build for a little while, I want to see if I can ensure that, no, I'm going to have these turns to build, which also could be healing of units and building more offensive units, so when that non-aggression pact expires, and I think that that's an important consideration as well, that it's not just a non-aggression pact from now until whenever, that there is a defined period of time for it, just like a peace treaty, just like a research agreement and the like.
When I'm doing the builder, and I try to just handle that through things like gifting, sort of currying favor in that sense, sort of a soft non-aggression pact, if you will, or an implicit non-aggression pact, just to get them to like me so much that they want to depend on me for, you know, the luxury resources or gold or whatever, rather than just locking them out completely. But, I mean, it's a good point you raise, actually. I hadn't thought of it that way.
Could be good for flavor, too, because you could definitely have the different AI personalities take different approaches in general to the non-aggression pacts, either being more biased towards signing them or not signing them, depending on situation. Maybe not make it impossible for anyone to sign them, or maybe one AI just never signs them, something like that. But for the most part, it's one of those sliding scales where some AIs will be very willing, typically, whereas others, you'll really have to work at it to get it.
Just like in a way that if you want to open borders with another civilization, you have to work to get them to like you enough, or at least not hate you enough, in order to get them to accept an embassy. And we also know that with regards to research agreements that you have to get to, we don't know if it's formal friends or at least a friendly disposition, but there's that extra step in there. So, yeah, you get that flavor in there that some AIs will be predisposed or not. And if you really want to shake it up, then you just click on random personalities, which is one of my favorite ones. And then it really comes down to, even more so, I think, your behavior self, how you've conducted yourself. But also, even if the AI thinks that it's a good idea in one respect, they may decide that, no, I don't want to do that because even though I haven't been aggressive towards you at this point, I am going to be able to roll over you. Just implicit non-aggression pact. I'm not willing to actually go that far to commit. Plus, that can also be another level of just how much, in practice, how much an AI likes you.
Now, in essence, a defensive pact is a non-aggression pact. Pretty sure that if you sign a defensive pact, they can't declare war on you at that point, can they?
Well, the thing with the defensive pact is, in a defensive pact situation, if you are declared on by somebody else, then that other civilization that you have that pact with declares war on the civilization that declared on you, whereas the non-aggression pact is more about, I'm not going to attack you, as opposed to, I'll declare war on someone who attacks you. And as we have seen, and humans can be guilty of this too, yes, in a defensive pact, let's declare war, but to actually do anything, practically speaking, in that war, you may
never. I've never seen that.
Yeah, paper war.
Exactly.
And it would make sense for people like Monty to not want to have declarations of friendship because he's always sizing you up as a target.
The thing about defense pacts is that, if you do declare war on anyone, your defense pact is broken. You essentially have no defense pact. So, yes, if you do declare on anyone else, your, defensive pact partner, won't go with you because, it's not defensive if you're the one declaring war.
Right.
And if you
it's not a preemptive strike like some countries like to do.
If you set a non-aggression pact with a civilization, if you know that it's going to expire after a certain amount of turns and then they go out and be aggressive, you may decide, okay, even if they want to renew the non-aggression pact, I'm not going to do that. A reflection of the fact that I don't approve of you going to attacking somebody else, so I'm not going to announce to the world, no, I'm going to force myself not to be able to attack that person, because it could be one of those situations as well where I really don't want to go to war with you unless you go to war with somebody else, and then you move your troops away from our shared border, and then I can turn around and...
So let me propose this scenario. What's the fall, then, if you have a defensive pact with one civ and a non-aggression pact with another civ, and the latter civ attacks the former? Something's got to trump there.
Well, you could have one but not the other to avoid that situation, but that's not so easily realized. Perhaps maybe it's just, I don't know, it's either guaranteed then that the non-aggression pact is not going to be renewed. Perhaps they don't declare war on you, but perhaps maybe there's some kind of economic sanction, like an embargo. Maybe we need an embargo mechanic or something like that. Or perhaps it's a situation where then the bribes another civ into war on their behalf. Or, precarious as it is, I don't know, gift a whole bunch of units or something like that. I don't know. It is kind of a slippery slope. But there's a balance in there. You're right. And I think that would need to be addressed. But on the whole, I think that we should actually get to that point, to that consideration, because everything else up to that point is making sense. And I think there's a way to work around that within everything that we've talked about here so that we actually have non-aggression pacts and they behave differently than a defensive pact or a declaration of friendship, which to me a declaration of friendship is an implicit non-aggression pact, a very strong one as opposed to just, friendly relations, but still an implicit one nonetheless.
You declared war on someone you had a declaration of friendship with, and there's no way we could have known it, but you take a demerit.
Whether civilization should have civil war is addressed here in a post by Josh Arrowwood. Thanks for having a name that is easy to pronounce, Josh. he says, I would love to see the concept of a civil war, somewhat like was in, I believe, Civ 2. If you get a certain size or take over lots of foreign land, you would be at higher risk when you suffer lots of unhappiness. Does anybody remember civil war in previous editions of Civ?
Yeah, in Civilization 2, the civil war mechanic was triggered when a very large civilization lost its capital.
Ah, So trying to think, like, basically whenever somebody suggests something like this, I'm trying to think, what are they going for? What is their goal here? Are we thinking of civil war as something that's a penalty for having lots of unhappiness? Is it a control mechanic for controlling ICS, where people are just getting bigger and bigger and bigger, expanding like crazy, which is, you know, a big issue in Civ 5? Do they just want a deeper game? You know, do they want to add some elements like this was Tropico or something like that to it, where you have factions and stuff within your empire?
You definitely wanted something that is measurable. As was actually pointed out by the Kaiko, nonetheless, you don't want it to just be random. Just because it can happen, it does happen. A lot of the discussion in the thread was related to happiness, actually, essentially getting to the, yes, we already have the slower growth when you go from happiness to unhappiness. You have the combat penalty when you get to minus 10, for example.
And those meaningless rebels, yeah.
Yeah, and then saying that if you continue to go down that negative path, that this could be another consequence. A lot of the discussion, or at least some of the discussion anyway, was about reaching a particular value of negative unhappiness beyond 10. Or it could even, and or you could even add into that how long in the game that you are at that unhappiness factor. Have you been 10 unhappy for 5 turns, 10 turns, 50 turns? And I know you can argue, well, heck, Dan, if you're at 10 unhappiness for 50 turns, you've probably already lost enough already. Well, maybe it's kind of one of those, if you didn't realize what it is that you had lost, now you really realize that you've lost that, because it's kind of one of those, it went from bad to really bad to worse.
So here's the thing. How does this really work? You know, you got one of two scenarios here. Cities or enemy units start spawning piecemeal, which you just roll in and crush. Or there's something abrupt where half your civilization is turned on you, which is probably a non-starter. It's probably not feasible to suddenly have half your civilization turn on you. How to make something like that work in the proper measure?
It was raised in the thread, and I'm agreeing with this, at least in theory. When it comes to practice and game testing, you get into some of the details and try to finesse it. But most likely, civil war is going to be triggered by a rather large civilization being too aggressive, and or a large civilization in decline, perhaps not able to protect themselves. It could be actually a measure of protection, but seeing as how we already have the happiness mechanic in Civilization V as it is, that it was argued, let me see, Ajuga, that the farther away that you are from a capital, the more happiness infrastructure you are going to need to lessen the likelihood that that particular city is going to break away. So it's true that you don't have like a Civilization II where when the civilization lost its capital, that there was a more or less even split between civilization that was always there and is now half the size, and the new civilization, which got a whole new leader. It was like, oh, new civilization not yet in the game is now suddenly here. And then the question becomes, how do they break away? Do they become an entirely separate civilization? Do they join an existing civilization that perhaps is adjacent on the front? Or as one person suggested, the King of Big Oz, that if they break away, they become a city-state. I wouldn't support seeing it actually join another civilization, and I'm hesitant about the city-state idea just because I could see that being exploited, and I know we use that term an awful lot. I like the idea that it becomes another civilization. This is to be a reflection of we are revolting against how it is that you are treating us, what you're doing, what you're not doing, and this is who we are, as then exemplified, practically speaking, as an entirely new civilization, instantly at war with that civilization, but that it would be possible later on to get to peaceful relations with that civilization, but it would take an, gosh, awful lot of effort.
I don't like game mechanics like this. You need some means of guaranteeing that it doesn't happen to you if you put in the right investment, because otherwise cities breaking off is just too devastating in civilization to make it an acceptable thing to have happen at random. It would be like the ultimate troll random event. And
so
in some cases, it would be the you lose button.
Yes, that's the thing. It would have to be measurable.
Right, maybe like a little meters filling up, a little unhappiness meters filling up over the city that you can look at.
Instead of how you get a golden age out of happiness, if your unhappiness is too high for too long, it fills up an opposite bar and you get a Civil War that way.
A poop age, yeah.
Exactly. Poop age.
A depression, maybe, or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, it would be kind of weird if you could, like, prevent a poop age by, like, preventing unhappiness by killing your people, which is what, you know, slavery does, which is what the slavery mechanic does. I mean, isn't that just a little bit counterintuitive?
Well, yeah, we're talking about Civ 5 here.
Right. Although you could starve your pop down in Civ 5 just to avoid that. It's true.
Yeah, you know, you could let your cities be taken from you. That makes people, that gets rid of people who are complaining.
Receive a nuke, you know? Although I guess I wouldn't really want to go to a civil war if the city next door just got nuked. You know, it's probably low on the priority suddenly. So I guess that sort of makes sense in this context anyway, and all about the happiness from being nuked.
So overall sentiment is what, thumbs down, thumbs up?
Thumbs up, so long as the conditions of triggering a civil war are not only measurable, but the steps that she would have to take to prevent that are reasonable. And I know those are very big qualifications. Cautious thumbs up.
Yeah, like I said, you'd need something over the cities that are considering civil, you know, considering secession. You know, you'd need like some kind of icon or something on it where the color is getting progressively more red or whatever. So you have some time to try to do something about it. It's not a random event. It's not a disaster. It's not an earthquake. You know, it's not a hurricane.
Yeah, save those for real life, and even then, yeah, we could do without.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have a thread started by Sharku. I believe that's, I don't know how else to pronounce that. So it started by Sharku. Anyone else notice this? Trading post available with Guilds Tech. And that's pretty much exactly what it says on the tin. And he asks, you don't get trading posts until the medieval era now? How am I supposed to make money and buy my way out of trouble now? Ugh, I see a lot of pain in my future. And my only thoughts are what the other people in this thread are thinking, that there's probably a change to the mechanics of getting gold in the early game as opposed to vanilla Civ 4. And trading posts have been an interesting thing in Civ 4. I once heard Majin comment that we don't need cottages brought back from Civ 4. And in the context of Civ 5, that's certainly true. However, I don't like the removal of tile improvement options in the early game unless we're being given other tile improvement options. It's basically the trading post started off too strong. I mean, it was pretty much not debatable that the 2 gold trading post available right at the start of the game was too strong. People were just spamming that for gold like nothing. And as you pushed it back, well, once it was nerfed, then they weren't really as good until you got that gold back later on. I don't see too much of a hindrance here, except for if you're going on a conquest spree early on, maybe you won't just be slamming the trading post button over and over again as you move your workers through your poppets. That's about the extent of the change in practice, I believe. But Guilds isn't that far down the tech tree, so we'll have to see how it goes. And hopefully you get some kind of dynamic where if you progress through the tech tree and social policy tree properly, you can set up a really powerful mid to late game economy by using them. And that is something I would like to see, because then you have to make your choices between your earlier setups versus your later setups and your worker turns. Then you would actually have some dynamic choice on tile improvements. So I'd like to see something other than farms practical then in the early game on the Flatlands now that trading posts are gone.
Yeah, as Eagle Pursuit said, you will adapt. I mean, we adapted when trading posts went from 2 tile yields so early in the game to 1. And I think now there's just more of an emphasis on a number of things. Number one, your markets, which are still available at currency, your luxury resources, particularly excess ones to sell. And then if we look just at the religion mechanic, we know that there are 3 founder beliefs that are tied to gold. Church property plus 2 gold for each city following the religion, initiation rites plus 100 gold when each city first converts to this religion, and tithe plus 1 gold for every 4 followers of this religion. But if you even exclude that, because we know it's possible that you will never found a religion, it'll be a while before a religion even spreads to you. But between the markets and the luxury resources, and then also establishing trade routes And also with the city focus with the governor, although I don't think that's the word that's used in Civ 5, I'm kind of blanking on it right now, setting it to goal focus. If you haven't done that before, haven't done that hardly at all, I think you'll be okay. But we know how powerful gold is, so I'm wondering if this is actually a measure to try to counter just how strong gold is in terms of if you have it kind of a thing, you can do this and this and this and this.
I'm mulling this over here. I'm trying to think of social policies that help you early on with gold.
There's one under...
Tradition?
Yeah, and I was thinking Liberty. There's the one where you get a golden age, and then there's one under Piety as well, although that would come a little later because it takes a little while longer in the game in order to be able to adopt Piety in the first place.
And I'm pretty sure Piety is going to see a major overhaul anyways when GNK comes out.
Oh, no doubt.
First time that's ever happened.
Okay, so monarchy at the bottom level of tradition is plus one gold for every two citizens in the capital.
They're saying the markets are earlier. Okay. If you have enough production, you could probably hammer that sucker out.
Well, the market still comes with the currency technology. It's not any earlier unless they're shifting currency around in terms of, you know, how many beakers it is or when it comes in terms of the prerequisites you need. I think the prerequisites are still the same. Maybe currency will be cheaper, but...
That would still make it earlier.
That's probably just going to end up being that you need to consider building markets in your already decent gold-producing cities because you get plus 2 gold, and then it's the plus 25% on top of the base gold that you have, which I know would then include the plus 2 gold, but still, to actually...
But how would you get that gold? How are you getting the stuff you're multiplying? There's got to be something, unless they change trade routes somehow.
Well, the trade routes, and also water. Improving your luxury resources.
Yes.
Water and coasts and rivers.
Man, oh, man.
Luxury.
The first time you could like actively seek to work those tiles specifically.
Yes. Imagine that.
Aside from being Colossus. The Colossus is the wonder that helps with gold.
We talked about keeping your empire at least solvent. We also talked about money. I want trading posts for talking about money. Perhaps takes us out of forum talk and into the news. Usually the news that we talk about is happy or at least neutral, but this is not.
This is a big, huge pile of suck.
We haven't really talked about Rise of Nations on Polycast before. It's a real-time strategy game. Like a Civ real-time strategy game. It came to us from Brian Reynolds, who was the lead designer on Civilization II. It was marketed as Rise of Nations, you know, build an empire over your lunch hour. That company, which he founded in 2000, called Big Huge Games, has been shut down. It was...
Wait a second, what? Since when? Really?
Yes, Big Huge Games is now defunct.
Like, literally just a week ago, basically.
Like, yeah, they sent out an email to everybody all at once on a Thursday afternoon. I think it was.
Yeah, that's how they found out. Now, I mean, that's how they officially found out that this is your official layoff notice effective today, Thursday, May 24th, 2012. I'm not saying this excuses the way that this was handled, by the way, in any way, but I think the writing was on the wall a little bit before then. I'm going to say it's a bit of a convoluted thing, but we kind of have to back up a little bit here. I will say that this was discussed on both episodes 263 and 265 of the TD Gaming Podcast, of which I'm also a regular co-host over at gamingpodcast.net. But what happened was Big Huge Games started off as an independent company. Brian Reynolds left for Axis Games. They developed Rise of Nations and an expansion pack for it, as well as a spiritual sequel, Rise of Nations, Rise of Legends, between 2002 and 2006. They were all published by Microsoft. THQ acquired Big Huge Games in 2008. It got sold to 38 Studios in 2009. THQ threatened that they were actually going to close down the studio if they couldn't find a buyer within 60 days, and they did. From mid-2009 to January 2012, Big Huge Games developed a single-player role-playing game entitled Kingdoms of Amalur: Reckoning, which was released at the end of February of this year. Published by Electronic Arts, available on the PC, the Xbox 360, and on the PlayStation 3. During this time, the state of Rhode Island offered 38 Studios, which owns Big Huge Games as a subsidiary, a $75 dollar state loan guarantee, yes, meaning that 38 Studios, if they were unable to pay off its loan for any other reason, the state would cover it for them, which Rhode Island and their taxpayers did to the tune, apparently, of over $112 million. The incentive was, relocate to Rhode Island, and you will get this loan. What happened was 38 Studios went to Rhode Island, but they kept Big Huge Games in Maryland, where it always was, as a second studio. Big Huge Games worked on their single-player game, while 38 Studios was working on a massively multiplayer online role-playing game. Well, earlier this month, 38 Studios missed the first loan payment to the state. So they got this money last year. A few months after the release of their game, they owed $1.125 million. And what happened after that, when they couldn't make that payment, is still a bit confusing. Rhode Island's governor said that the failure of the company was that, and selling only 1.7 or 1.9 million copies, they needed to sell 3 million copies in order for the company to break even. They had not met sales expectations, and therefore, when they couldn't make the loan payment, and then in turn couldn't make payroll, that was the end of the company, and they were shutting it down.
Yeah, and there's some people that are debating that whether that was the 3 million mark was actually the thing, or they had actually done well enough. It may not have been the numbers that the state wanted or something.
So, have any of you guys actually, have you guys played Kingdoms of Amalur?
No.
It's really a tragedy. It's a great game. To see it die is a great new IP.
Yeah, because I'd heard positive things about it. I think It just got a little bit overshadowed by Diablo 3 coming out.
I mean, 1.2 million is actually for a console game. It's a success for a new IP in the console.
Yeah.
And at this stage of the late stage of the Xbox and PS3, that's a good number. That's a number that some people would crack champagne over.
Apparently, so, by Rhode Island.
I guess they just had high expectations. You know, they do call themselves Big Huge Games, so.
Well, they're not so huge anymore. I think Curtis Schilling stands to lose about 50 million of his own out of his own pocket.
He's lost for us, really, as a game community.
It's a tragedy. But Governor Chaffee is sort of being portrayed as the villain here because he came out and made all these remarks about the game being a failure when it sold 1.2 million and basically bashed the company. Supposedly Curt Schilling says they were actually in the middle of a negotiation with another publisher, people suspect EA, and he kind of killed that deal with his comments. It's like a $35 million deal.
Yeah, because he revealed, against 38 Studios' wishes, that the launch date of the company's next project was being delayed until next June. And so when they said that, yeah, the $35 million, that financing, all of a sudden, whoever was going to put in that money went, whoa, what do you mean it's delayed? Okay, forget about it, the deal is off. So then in turn, like Steve was saying, that then Chaffee could say, oh, well, that deal fell through, there is no money, so therefore that's the end of the company. It wasn't Chaffee himself who approved this deal, by the way. It was his predecessor who gave 38 Studios this deal.
I see some political overtones in that.
So I found that out, and I'm like, okay. Because it's kind of like, why would you shoot yourself in the foot?
You shoot your predecessor's project in the foot because you hated him.
Exactly. And what ends up happening is 38 Studios and Big Huge Games, including Curt Schilling, the founder of 38 Studios, and all of 38 Studios employees and Big Huge Games employees, which is just shy of 400, get caught in the crossfire. The only positive thing about this is there has been a major supportive response, not just in terms of words, but also we're starting to get indications that a lot of these very talented individuals are being offered positions at other companies. And the thing is that there are some people, for example, with regards to the relocation, who have, of course, some mortgage issues now.
Yeah.
And my understanding also is that in the United States, in terms of your health coverage goes once.
Yeah.
So forget about even, you know, 2 or 3 weeks. Like, welcome to, like, 3 or 4 days of health care coverage. And I know the writing was on the wall, but when we look back at what led us to this point, and then also, how did tell the employees that it was in an email, and it's like it's effective today? I mean, heck, it's possible that some people actually found about it in a news source before they even checked their email. That's not how you treat people. You know, some people have looked at this in the gaming industry and said, well, what do you expect? I mean, this is the way the gaming industry is. Either it's a combination of the poor economy in general. You could say that about anything. And that, yes, that as projects come and go and they're in development and then they're finished and people end up getting laid off, that there is a turnover. But this is a bit more than a turnover here. We're talking about the end of not one, but two companies. And combined with the fact that, oh, more than $100 million in taxpayers' money, gone.
Yep.
Yeah, they didn't even try to let them go along for a little longer to see if they could recoup any of that investment. This other guy who stepped in just said, nope, shut it down.
I mean, you think about it, 1.2 million copies at $60 a pop. That's, what, around $75 million right there. So,
yeah.
You know.
They had another project that was within a year of release. It'd be more money. They could have done.
Yeah, 1.2 million copies at $50. That's $60 million. I know there were some collector's editions that were going for up to $300.
Right, and it retailed for $60, so we're closer to around the 70-something.
That's a pretty important number because, oh, what was that loan again?
$75 million.
Yeah, some of it went to EA as their publisher, but still.
What you're saying is that that figure just vanishes in 3 months, and you don't even have a fraction of that amount on hand otherwise. Like, if this was your entire revenue stream, you had nothing else in reserve at all, you were 100%.
They may not have. And maybe why they took the loan in the first place. This has sunk other companies over the years, not just Big Huge Games, but this is what being too much far into debt is why Origin had to be bought by Electronic Arts years ago, and they ended up being like completely absorbed.
Yeah, it's just that development cycle where it takes years to make
it's
a game
harsh.
And tens of millions of dollars.
It didn't used to be so big, but it is now.
Right.
I think that there is shared responsibility here from Schilling, from Chaffee, and I'm not saying they're not negatively impacted, but the people that had no say in it, which were the employees of the company, and I know it's not fair, especially when I compare the employees of 38 Studios and Big Huge Games, but I mean, Big Huge Games was even more removed from this because they were the subsidiary. I mean, they were completely along for the ride, as were 38 Studios' own direct employees, don't get me wrong. And as far as, you know, Big Huge Games, the fact that they were purchased by 38 Studios from THQ because THQ threatened to shut them down because of economic problems that they couldn't afford to keep the studio. So 38 Studios was the savior, but then 38 Studios went around and entered into a poor arrangement, and then that poor arrangement was compounded by political meanderings afterwards. That kind of that perfect storm combinations, it just blew up.
That's about the size of it.
It's true that Brian Reynolds is no longer with Big Huge Games. He's now off at Zynga, and we've talked about that before. And some other notable names related going to Zynga, most recently Soren Johnson. But still, given the pedigree of the talent and the titles, recent and not so recent, from Rise of Nations to the Kingdoms of Amalur, for a developer to end in this abrupt, violent way.
Right after launching a successful new IP, no less.
An IP they spent like 6 years in development, hiring R.A. Salvatore and Todd McFarlane to develop. They put a lot into this.
Like, yes.
A very rare effort that you see. It should have paid off.
Of course, a lot of that money was spent in this development on THQ and Big Huge Games' dime, because by the time they got into 38 Studios purchasing it, a lot of it had already been done. So, I mean, yes, 38 Studios paid, but there was a lot that was kind of, you know, the momentum was already there. The fact that it was just released in February and then to say, oh, hasn't met sales expectations, yoink, just seemed to be...
Yeah, that's just...
What are you talking about?
2 months, yeah. Is that
seriously?
Something like that, yeah.
The point as well that you made, Steve, about, I mean, not so much on the PC, but the Xbox 360 and the PlayStation 3. We talked about this, like, on episode 264, 262, something like that, of the TV Gaming Podcast. We're getting to the end of the current console generation, going from the 7th to the 8th, to the 8th to the 9th, I forget which. So, with all of the titles that are already out there on those platforms, for this game to come out now and to have that much of a response in such a short amount of time is encouraging and should have been received that way, and it was, except for those people that were holding the purse strings.
Yeah, maybe if this goes into default, somebody else will grab up the IP, but of course that's small consolation for a lot of people.
Rest in peace, Big Huge Games, and may you in fact indeed rest in peace, only because there have been some well-known companies quote-unquote resurrected, some successful, some not. That was
like the resurrection of MicroProse that time?
I'm thinking of the resurrection of MicroProse, and I'm going to throw an Atari in there, too. Don't do that.
Oh.
Truly rest in peace.
Amen.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast, our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Early use of gunpowder was not really, I mean, in a historical context, it wasn't really that useful because you had no, like, real, I don't know, aiming power. I mean, it was only when, like, muskets came along that you had some of that, but, of course, you know, when they came up with rifles, it was much better. But, oh, God, what was the name of that one thing? They used to have this one really terrible gun, and it would basically just kind of, like, blow up in your face most of the time.
The harquebus?
Yes. Oh,
that was
great.
But I wasn't sure.
Yeah. The harquebus was a complete crap, man. I mean, come on. I mean, if we had harquebus instead, that would be like the land version of the Ironclad.
Yeah, you'd have to light a fuse and just sit there and wait for it to burn out before your gun would go off. So, yeah.
I wouldn't want to be on either side of it.
Roll the dice. Today it kills you, tomorrow it kills your opponent.
Just wait until you get close enough, it blows up, kills you both. Yeah.
Bomb on a stick, look out.
Polycast is building. Polycast has left the building.
Oh, I thought you said Polycast was debilitating, and I thought.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
You're a little subjective, you need a hearing aid.
We are ending on a down note a little bit. So, yeah.
That's different from selective hearing, Dan.
What's that?
Wrong direction.
Did you say I needed a maid? Well, this has been Polycast episode 148. I've been joined by our guest co-host, Steve.
Hi. Thanks, guys, for having me.
Lisa, one of our regular co-hosts. I guess Lisa objects to being called a regular co-host. Well, you think you would have gotten used to it after all this time, but...
I think she left the building.
Oh. Yeah. Me and team.
I'll put down any civil war as necessary, just like I put down other problems.
Makalua.
This is too late. We've said everything.
And myself, Dan Q. It's a bright, bright, bright sunshiny day. I can see clearly now, and the rain is...
No singing rule. Still applies.
I wasn't singing that guy. I don't know which
one. You were getting there.
She participated in or won the sing-off, so she actually doesn't
have to lie.
Or was I on mute?
You were on mute.
Okay, I was seeing a bunch of things, man. I was like, I'm here, what the... And then you went on. Okay, well, I am here.
All right. Say goodbye now, Lisa.
Sorry!
Lisa wanted the last word, which I just totally usurped, but...
Last word!
Die Erzherzogin zu Österreich heißt Eure Eminenz willkommen in... Ach, bringen wir es hinter uns. Um 4 wird gespeist.
Rocking Amadeus.
Some people even thought that she was sounding a little seductive in that, and I'm thinking, oh
come on, look at Catherine.
Is that a treaty in your pocket?
Basically.
Couldn't the Arthur take cities for a little while? Like, wasn't there a glitch with that at first before it was patched out?
Must have been an even narrower window than the uberness that mounted units were initially upon Sapphire release.
Well, that was a decently long window.
Cottages, troll face. If we're closer to April Fools, I bet you Firaxis would pull that crap out.
When it comes to April Fool's jokes, though, I don't know how you top extreme diplomacy. That was just... I always come back to that.
Yeah, that was. That
you
was
know, amazing. I actually fell for that one, right? Do you remember?
I do.
I don't want to play Civ 5. Well, now I want to play Civ 5, but for different reasons. I don't want to see those Firaxis guys whip anything out, so, yeah.
I mostly whip out units, personally.
Units?
Units.
Onward and upward, or at least just onward, perhaps?
Downward?
Yeah, let's go with the onward approach.
Record date, June 2nd, 2012. Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips, copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.